Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
We're always happy to extol the virtues of the powerless, forgiving the powerful, but we too often do not ask the powerful why they are not, for instance, forgiving debts that have accumulated, why we don't wipe the slate clean the other way.
That's the voice of author and academic Dr. Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen about the recent passing of Mandela, the opportunity the holidays provide in talking about the important issues, and the simple things we can do as citizens to promote social change. So stay tuned.
My next guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. He is author. He's written many books. One of my favorites is All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice. And we're very privileged to have him on our program today. He's also the author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to our program, Robert.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Now, we've been talking with Graham Russell about the impact of the recent elections in Honduras. And I think it's timely to talk a little bit about the role that neoliberalism has had in not only creating a narrative, this monologic narrative of how society should be organized, you know, in terms of privatizing, outsourcing, making workers into vulnerable legions of temporary workers, and in some cases, not even that. But I think it's important to recognize that this has been pronounced as the pragmatic approach to creating robust economies. So I wonder if we could begin talking about what has been lost in the last three decades of neoliberal policies and why it is important for us to take notice and stand up.
Yeah, well, it's not only in the economic sphere, of course, but across all aspects of life. That neoliberal model, and of course there's a specific economic meaning to those terms about, as you pointed out, markets and trade and privatization and the end of regulation. But there's also a kind of deeper sense in which neoliberalism defines human beings even in non-economic arenas. So take higher education where I work. Market language, market models, talking about metrics and deliverables and an obsession with measurement, a belief that competition is always the way to go at these things. I mean, that's invading education, even up to and including higher education. So neoliberalism not only has redefined economic relationships, in a sense, it's redefined our sense of self. And increasingly, people have a hard time thinking outside of that and using language that isn't rooted in the market. And that's what, in some ways, is the most disturbing part of it. The way it's sort of reconfiguring our own sense of what it means to be human. That is always what disturbs me the most.
In your book, All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, you write about the fourth fundamentalisms. And I wonder if we could talk briefly about that, because as you pointed out, not only have we been are we being indoctrinated into how we should think about each other, you know, neoliberalism also dictates, you know, what is possible to be thought about.
Right. So these fundamentalisms that we're talking about, of course, everybody's familiar with religious fundamentalism, a kind of absolute certainty in a particular perspective on the divine. And everyone understands the danger of religious fundamentalism, and that danger is real. We've also been talking about this economic fundamentalism, the neoliberal model, the markets must always decide our fate. That idea is also, the consequences of that are clear. And of course, we also know there's a kind of national fundamentalism. That's most pronounced typically in the most powerful countries, such as the United States. A national fundamentalism, a kind of hyper-patriotism that leads people to believe literally that their nation state can do no wrong. Well, all of those are fundamentalisms that we're used to talking about and critiquing. We also, I think, have to start speaking more about what some of us call technological fundamentalism, the belief that the high energy, high technology gadgets that have defined our lives in the first world in recent years, our fate, that in fact, whatever problems might be caused by all this high energy, high technology under a technological fundamentalism, all the problems caused can be solved by simply more technology. So we're in the grips of all of these fundamentalisms. And as we look at the cascading ecological crises that define our world today, it may be that the technological fundamentalism may be our undoing. All of these are fundamentalisms we need to beware of, but I think, you know, the technological one we often don't think enough about, and it may in fact be the most dangerous.
It's interesting that you point that out, because to me, the technological and the nationalistic, you know, fervor kind of go hand in hand, in that, you know, when we think about the economy, for instance, just being a series of algorithms, you know, dictating whether the market went up or down, we lose sight of the people who are impacted by the kinds of things that are being traded, what are being promoted as, you know, areas of growth. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the connection. We're always talking about being in a post-colonial era. You know, colonialism was this nasty thing that happened where European or even Western countries like the U.S. and Canada went abroad and occupied other countries, and we just don't do that. You know, I mean, we would like to believe that we're evolved, and that now we have these democratic systems in place like the U.N. or, you know, the World Bank, which are totally undemocratic from the perspective of Latin Americans. But we have been seduced into believing that we are now post-colonial, that, you know, colonialism was an ugly thing that happened, but it's now past. And I think that the two go hand in hand, because we are now facing climate change, and under climate change, a new era of colonial power has been unleashed, an ecological imperialism, if you would. I wonder if you could talk about this.
Well, you know, certainly the old model of European colonialism through direct invasion and conquest and the creation of either an imperial government or a puppet government, that model has changed, of course, as the world has changed. But the notion behind imperialism is not just about the direct conquest. It's about the undermining of the sovereignty of another people. And so we talk routinely in the post-World War II era about U.S. imperialism, for instance, about the ways, usually not direct invasion, but the ways that the U.S. have undermined the sovereignty of other peoples. And that's about control and a demand for, a desire for, a belief in the ability to control. And as you pointed out, that's all bound up in this belief that you can quantify and sort of mechanize the world. And, of course, as you pointed out, the real needs of real human beings, especially those on the bottom of an economic ladder, tend to disappear from view in that world. And now you're adding the climate justice question, which, especially in the last few years, is impossible to avoid, that the consequences of this technological fundamentalism that primarily has come out of the West are now being felt primarily in the developing world, the third world, whatever term you want to use. And that's another remnant of, you could even say, form of this kind of imperialism, the demand by the developed, the West, that they control these things, that they not accept the needs of and demands of the third world, the developing world. We saw this in the most recent climate talks. It goes back, it's a long history, of the West simply not taking responsibility and claiming the right to control how all of this works out. I think you're right. It's all part of the same mindset that says those who dominate must dominate by virtue of their moral superiority. Their ability to control is unquestioned. And now the whole system is sort of unraveling, but the power dynamics remain, and even in a post-colonial world, those power dynamics in which the West still has an inordinate amount of control continue.
I was invited to the president's party at the university, and one of my coworkers said, you know, isn't this lovely? And I said, well, I would like to consider, I said, you know, what it would be like if we, instead of having this gathering, we actually hold a discussion with students about what they would wish for, right? And if you were to ask me, I said, I would wish for an end to capitalism. And that was only half jokingly, because deep down in my heart, I believe that that would be one step towards creating a society on more equitable terms. But immediately the reaction was one of horror in her face. She says, oh, we wouldn't want that. She says, of course we would want a society where people feel they can compete and be their most productive selves. And I thought, here's a person who has been highly educated. I mean, she held several degrees, and yet is unable to even consider or imagine a world without capitalism. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Well, that's a particularly disturbing part of contemporary higher education, you know, certainly in the U.S., but I think in Canada and elsewhere as well. Precisely at the moment that we need a kind of independent academy, that is, people who are willing to think critically and think outside of the existing systems, unfortunately, our universities are mostly captured by those systems. So it's easy, you know, in my classroom to talk critically about capitalism, but once you get to the level of seriously trying to marshal the forces of the university to think critically about this in a more systematic way, well, then there's no support for that whatsoever. And that's not surprising because, again, looking at the way this neoliberal model has not only defined economic relations, but defined so many other relations, the university increasingly operates, you know, just like a corporation. And so the idea that the university should criticize, reflect on, and maybe even be an engine for social change that would allow us to transcend the corporation, to go beyond capitalism, is kind of unthinkable. And so I'm not at all surprised by the report you just offered. That's probably the norm, in that most people in universities are no more interested in that conversation than they would be in the boardrooms of most American corporations.
You know, I was thinking about not only are we shaped by our ideas. Eduardo Galeano says it's not true that we're only made of atoms. We're also made of stories, and the kinds of stories that are possible. You know, I was invited to speak on a radio in South Africa regarding the passing of Nelson Mandela, and every report was about this man as the hero of an era, and you know, this fear that the country might fall apart now that he's gone. And of course, immediately I said, I completely agree with you that Nelson Mandela was a remarkable human being, a wonderful man. I said, and I also want to recognize the people that shape his consciousness, the people who fought and died alongside trying to release him, to free him, and to free, you know, all black South Africans from, you know, the reign of apartheid. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about it, because when we think about a prophetic voice, to me, it means recognizing the different voices that shape us. And I think religion, just as much as the academy, just as much as the media, has had a huge influence on how we understand power and how we have, we understand this notion of forgiveness. You know, everybody wants to, including President Obama, came on and said, you know, this is a man who forgave and taught us how to live. And I thought, yes, and that should be commendable. However, we can't just forgive without having reparation, without creating a new kind of structure that at least allows people access to have, you know, a different kind of engagement with each other.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the Mandela funeral and the whole series of events around his death have been very interesting. There's been a lot of commentary about how the legacy of Mandela has been, you know, co-opted by the right, you know, not critiqued enough for the problems he had as well as the successes. Because when Mandela emerged from prison and began the process of taking a leadership role, there were decisions that he and other ANC leaders made, and those decisions can and should be critiqued. So all of that's going on, and that's appropriate. But whenever these things happen, I always ask, what can we learn about ourselves? You know, Mandela, a complex human being, is being turned into a, in some sense, a caricature. And that says a lot about where we're at, I think. You know, much in the way that every year in the United States on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, you can tell a lot by who you're talking to, by how they're constructing King. I think we're going to have the same ability to know a lot about people by how they construct Mandela. And as you point out, a lot of the complexity is already fading. The decision not to hold white society accountable for its crimes under apartheid is being lauded as forgiveness. Was, in fact, that the right approach? Should there have been a more honest reckoning of those crimes? Should wealth have been redistributed in a more just way as a way of, as you point out, pursuing reparations? All of those questions were decided one way, but it doesn't mean that was the right way. And we don't learn from history by pretending that complex human leaders were without problems. We learn from history by going back and revisiting decisions and asking, in the light of history, what we know now, was it in fact the right decision? And I think a lot of people have concluded that many of the fundamental choices the ANC made as it took power in the early 1990s were probably misguided. And that's why poor South Africans, mostly poor black South Africans, are economically in no better shape today than they were under apartheid. And in fact, some are even worse off because of the neoliberal policies that the ANC eventually embraced. So all of this should be the subject of discussion, debate, not the fodder for, at this point, I'm ready to say after all of this, almost a kind of parody, especially when leaders from countries like the United States weigh in eloquently without talking about the United States' real history and its support of apartheid over the years.
You know, as we approach Christmas, we seem to have this sense of forgiveness, of new beginnings, of starting over. And I think that the message of reciprocity, the message of human kindness, the message of being kind to our enemies is something that has always been very appealing. I think for most of us, you know, most people, I believe, would be kind even to their enemies, you know, when given the chance. The question is perhaps, how do we reclaim these messages? Because I would argue Christ would not have, you know, built a wall against, you know, around Palestine. Christ would not have bombed, you know, Iraq and all of these things that I, and perhaps, as you said, you know, it says a lot about me, or who I am, by the way, I would imagine how Christ would have acted. But in thinking about Christianity and the central message of Christianity, how can we learn a new course that can help us turn back the clock, not just on neoliberalism or racism or patriarchy, but also reimagine ourselves anew, reimagine ourselves in new relations?
Right. You know, if I can go back to the question of forgiveness, because you made a very important point. Everybody is praising the ANC and Mandela for forgiving white society. And that's that's forgiveness that went from the bottom to the top. The people who had been oppressed forgave the oppressor. But remember that forgiveness can go the other way, and your mention of religion is important because in the tradition, the both the Judaic and the Christian tradition, that forgiveness had an actual term, jubilee, which meant a kind of forgiveness of debt, a reapportionment of land after 49 years. You know, so we're always happy to extol the virtues of the powerless forgiving the powerful, but we too often do not ask the powerful why they are not, for instance, forgiving debts that have accumulated, why we don't wipe the slate clean the other way, because that's what would produce real equality and real economic justice. And you're right that the Christmas season is a good time to remember that. You know, people have different reactions to and relationships to religion. For some people, it's a source of comfort and strength. For others, it's been a source of trauma. And so I never want to, you know, generalize too much about people's reactions to religion, especially in a country like the U.S., which is often so intensely Christian in the face of a multi-religious society. But I think those values you talk about should be talked about year-round, but especially at these key holidays like Christmas and Easter, where notions of forgiveness can be not only talked about in the abstract, but put into practice. So, you know, whatever one's personal relationship to a religious tradition, one lives in a world defined in large part by religion. And so taking up the concepts from religion, like forgiveness, like redemption, specific concepts like jubilee, a kind of wiping, an idea that you wipe the slate clean periodically so that people can kind of come back into right relation with each other. Those are all very powerful, powerful concepts that are just sitting right there, right in the tradition, and we should be, as you point out, talking about them much more aggressively than I think we tend to.
I wanted to perhaps have a brief moment to recognize not only the things that have prevented us from even imagine that kind of forgiveness, you know, being possible. And one, as you were talking about the Jubilee, this idea that, you know, why not forgive debts, you know, especially when there's many of those debts are odious debts that were accrued through colonial processes that enslaved people. How do we, because people say, well, I'm just one person, how can I change a whole structure of racism, of sexism, of militarism? You know, it's going to happen whether I like it or not. How do we change that and recognize our own agency in the way that people who have a lot of the time less resources than us, you know, like the people in Honduras, where if you ask them, they're like, the struggle continues. The coup has now become a verb. It's, you know, it's a way of life. It's a recognition that if we're going to live with dignity, standing up is not an option. It's just the way we live.
Well, you're absolutely right. When people say, you know, I'm only one person, the first thing to do is say, you're absolutely right. We're all only one person. But if we're going to hold up, you know, figures like Mandela or King as examples, well, they were only one person too, but they were one person working in collaboration with many others. So, you know, the fact that we live at a particular moment in history where there are not strong popular movements for social justice, that's true enough. This is, you know, 2013, not 1968 or, you know, some other period where there were more vibrant movements. But we have to remember, number one, that all the periods in history where there was a lot of social change happening in the moment were made possible by decades and even centuries of work done by people before that. So being a person of conscience and wanting to get involved in work for social justice doesn't mean you're guaranteed, you know, that you will see immediate results this year or next year or even in your own lifetime. You make commitments to these things because in some ways it's the right thing to do, not because you're going to succeed necessarily overnight. And the other reason to do it is not only, I think, because it's the right thing to do, it's because that's what creates a meaningful life. You know, people have different talents and temperaments and different things they enjoy doing, but I think everybody agrees that a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose is essential to leading a good life. And if we all want to be fulfilled, if we all want to be happy, if we all want to say we lead a good life, there has to be somewhere meaning in that. Now, for some people, meaning comes from, you know, making a lot of money or gathering a lot of status or, you know, lots of, you know, fancy toys or so. I don't know. All I can say is for myself, those kinds of things never provided much meaning. And so I think, you know, just as you were saying around the holidays, it's a time to talk about forgiveness and these questions. It's also a time to talk about the, I think, what is the most enduring question in human history, which is, what does it mean to lead a good life? You know, this is one of the core questions of philosophy, and it's as relevant today as it has ever been. And so I think one of the things we can do, I'm not talking now about specific political projects, people get involved in those and that's good, but I also think we can commit to, in our daily life, when we're with friends, family, wherever we're at, that we don't shy away from talking about these questions. Often people think it's almost kind of embarrassing to talk about meaning in life and what it means to be a good person. It's almost seen as kind of naive. But I think we have to, you know, brave the occasional cynicism we bump into and bring those up. Maybe the most important thing is to be willing to be laughed at. People laugh at me all the time. My faculty colleagues, when I try and raise these things, love to make jokes about it. Well, that's okay. But, you know, being the subject of laughter has never hurt anybody. I think that's a really, I don't know, maybe it's just that we are coming up on the holidays and people will be around family and friends a lot, that it seems to me so important to be willing to simply be naive around other people and express to people that you think these questions about a good life are, in fact, central.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice. It's a beautiful book. In your book, you talk about this new communion, and we only have a minute left, but I wonder if you could just inspire our audience. How do we restore that spiritual connection that allows to have precisely that center to joyousness, to, you know, to being connected, to being in communion with others?
Well, I think this is what some theologians call the concept of being in right relation, you know, with other people, with ourselves, and then, of course, with the larger living world. And I think the way we do that is always pretty much the same, which is to commit to activities in which our own, you know, short-term material interests are not primary. In other words, we commit to an endeavor that is for the greater good. And whenever we do that, I think we get a little step closer to that right relation that is so crucial to us all.
Thank you so much for being with us. We've been speaking with Robert Jensen. He is the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.